Chapter 5. At the Summer School. The Buddhist Society's summer school was the highlight of the British Buddhist year and had been so for more than a decade. It lasted a week and was held at Hai Li, a conference centre on the outskirts of Hoddesdon, a small town in Hertfordshire. People came to it from all over the country. They came to meet fellow Buddhists and sympathisers with Buddhism, to attend lectures and classes, and to buy books on Buddhism and other Eastern religions that were not easily obtainable outside London. That year I was the principal teacher, and as such was kept fully occupied. According to a report later published in Sangha, the monthly journal of the Buddhist Sangha Association, in the course of the week I conducted 6 meditation sessions, delivered 10 lectures, held a question and answer meeting, participated in the school's concluding Brains Trust, and recorded 2 interviews for the BBC. As the report went on to say, quote, "The Venerable Sevira's experience at the summer school, where he contacted a representative cross-section of English Buddhists, besides meeting old friends, was a great help to him in assessing the present position of the Buddhist movement in England." One of the old friends I met was the author and translator John Blofeld, who 4 or 5 years earlier had spent 3 weeks with me in Kalimpong. He was not only a friend but a fellow disciple, the two of us having received the Vajrasattva initiation together from Dujom Rinpoche. Another report, which appeared in The Middle Way, the quarterly journal of the Buddhist Society, spoke of me as combining the 3 approaches of the Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana, and as showing how the seeds of the last 2 are found in the first, and how the later developments grew without losing the fundamentals of the earlier approach. At the morning study classes, according to the same source, I outlined the Theravada and Tibetan schools. 33 years later, I have little or no distinct recollection of all this, which is why I'm having to rely on the 2 journals for an account of what was, nevertheless, my first important assignment on my return to England. But although I have no distinct recollection of what I did at my first summer school, in the way of delivering lectures and conducting meditation classes, a few vivid, if unconnected, impressions still remain, one of them sufficiently striking for me to have wanted to set it down in my notebook shortly afterwards. There also survives an article I wrote for The Middle Way on 20 Years After, Impressions of Buddhism in England. In this article I commented on the fact that a high proportion of Western Buddhists seemed interested in meditation. I also gave an account of an experiment in guided meditation, as I called it, that I conducted at the morning meditation sessions. The dining room at Hai Li was occupied by rows of long tables with seating on either side. There were separate tables for vegetarians and non-vegetarians. At breakfast the first day I joined the vegetarians, among whom were Maurice Walsh, the chairman of the English Sangha Trust, and his wife Ruth, both of whom had already been to see me at the Vihara. In previous years, monks attending the summer school had always eaten by themselves, thus reinforcing the rigid Theravadin separation between monks and the lay community, and the fact that I chose to do otherwise occasioned a certain amount of astonishment. But it also gave rise to a good deal of pleasure, so that I still have a vivid impression of the satisfaction and delight with which people received me when I sat down at their table that morning, and the joy with which they hastened to serve me. Christmas Humphreys and his entourage, I noticed, were not vegetarians. Anne Lobstein may or may not have been part of the entourage. She was a short, fresh-faced woman of about 40, who, I afterwards learned, had written an article that the editor of The Middle Way refused to accept, on the grounds that it contained, besides an account of the writer's mystical experiences, revelations concerning her love life. At the summer school, she took the morning study class in Zen, and it was this class I decided to sit in on as part of my program of informing myself about the current state of Buddhism in Britain. When I walked in, the class was pleasantly surprised, but Anne looked shocked. "Oh no," she cried, "this is not fair." "In Zen, everything is fair," I retorted as I took my seat, and the poor woman had no alternative but to proceed. There would be a short period of quiet reflection, she at length announced in an unsteady voice, presumably so that she would have time to compose herself. When we had sat with closed eyes for 10 or 15 minutes, she gave a confused, rambling talk about the trees and the flowers and the butterflies and about the blue sky and the bright sunshine, and indeed it was a glorious August day outside, and about how it was all one and how that was Zen. Years later, when we were better acquainted, she told me that the episode had caused her deep embarrassment. She was then new to Zen and had never taken a Zen class before, but Mr. Humphreys had asked her to do so, and as she regarded him as her teacher, she was a member of his Zen class at the Buddhist Society, she felt unable to refuse. Humphreys himself spoke more than once that week, his principal contribution in this regard being the evening lecture he gave on A Buddhist Travelogue. In this lecture, he compared the spiritual life to climbing up the side of a mountain, and at one point described the spiritual mountaineer as, quote, "hacking off great bleeding lumps of self," unquote, in the course of his ascent. The violent image made me shudder at the time, and it makes me shudder still. Of my own lectures, I remember nothing. I do, however, remember an incident that took place immediately before one of them. Christmas Humphreys was to take the chair. On arriving at the lecture hall, I found him waiting impatiently outside the door. "You're 2 minutes late," he observed disapprovingly, looking up at the clock above the lintel as though for confirmation of his words. I could hardly explain that in India I was accustomed to meetings beginning 2 hours late, and murmured something about not having a watch. The upshot was that the following day he sent me into Hoddesdon with Muriel Dorr, his meeting secretary, to choose a watch for myself at the local jeweller's. The day being my birthday, it would be a birthday present to me from him and the Buddhist Society. At the jeweller's, I unwittingly selected what I afterwards came to know was a quite expensive watch. But it lasted me a long time and served to remind me that I was now living in a different culture with a different set of values, one of which was punctuality. The impression that was sufficiently striking for me to want to set it down in my notebook once I was back at the Vihara related to the demonstrations of Ikebana, the Japanese art of flower arrangement, that were given towards the end of the week by Stella Ko and her pupils. Stella Ko was a leading Ikebana teacher, so I gathered, and a regular visitor to the summer school. Some of the flower arrangements appeared to have a therapeutic effect. This was especially the case with an arrangement representing a thoroughly selfish person carrying a heavy coil of knotty karma, the work of a stout middle-aged woman in a blue dress. As my notebook entry went on to ask, quote, "Did the almost hysterical laughter of the audience represent a release of tension brought about by the recognition in consciousness of the dark side of themselves? Does the traditional Japanese art have this therapeutic effect, or is it merely aesthetic? Or are the two not inseparable?" Miss Ko and her pupils, except the young man, a comparative beginner, had a peculiarly radiant grace and kindliness which might perhaps be the result of continually evoking, through the flower arrangements, images of beauty from the unconscious and incorporating, even assimilating, them into consciousness. Whatever the explanation may have been, the grace and kindliness of Stella Coe and her three women pupils was very evident, and it gladdened my heart to see such a high degree of emotional positivity. The differences that had arisen between the Sangha Association and the Buddhist Society were connected with the teaching of a particular form of meditation. I was therefore concerned to find out what place meditation occupied in the lives of British Buddhists. And in my article, 20 Years After, I touched on the subject. A high proportion of Western Buddhists seemed interested in meditation, and it was significant that at the summer school there were four different meditation sessions a day, all of them well attended. In view of the alarmingly high incidence of mental strain and disorder, this interest was natural, I observed, adding that it was always to be borne in mind that the significance of Buddhist meditation was not merely psychological, but primarily spiritual. In other words, its goal was enlightenment. The article continues, quote, "Some people at the summer school, however, regretted that a wider range of meditation practices were not available. As one of them told me, 'We aren't attracted by Zen, and we don't like Vipassana, and there doesn't seem to be much anywhere in between.' Actually, there is very much in between. At the 9:30 meditation sessions, I conducted an experiment in what I afterwards called guided meditation. The class progressing from one stage to another of metta-bhavana, development of love, practice, as directed at 5-minute intervals by the voice of the instructor. Verbal directions were gradually reduced to a minimum until, in the last session, transition from one stage to the next was indicated merely by strokes on the gong. The experiment seemed successful, and it may be possible to apply the same technique to the teaching of other types of meditation. In any case, I feel strongly that there is a great need among English Buddhists for a wider and more intensive practice of the so-called classical systems of meditation, such as metta-bhavana and anapanasati, respiration mindfulness, which are common to all jhanas and which constitutes the indispensable foundation of the more advanced techniques. I also feel that less attention is paid than might be to the devotional side of the Buddha's teaching. As the formula of the five spiritual faculties reminds us, faith, shraddha, and wisdom, prajna, energy, virya, and meditation, samadhi, must be in perfect equilibrium. Mindfulness, smriti, is always useful. The vipassana that some people at the summer school didn't like was the controversial Burmese insight meditation that Ananda Bodhi had been teaching, about which I shall have something to say later on. My experiment in guided meditation was an experiment in the sense that I had not taught meditation in this way before, and as the experiment was successful, it did prove possible to apply the same technique to the teaching of types of meditation other than metta-bhavana. Guided group meditation, as I now called it, came to be the standard way in which I taught metta-bhavana and anapanasati to beginners in meditation, both at the Vihara and elsewhere. This served to encourage the practice of the classical systems of meditation among English Buddhists, some of whom were inclined to hanker after more so-called advanced methods of development.